We are quickly approaching the end of 2024. And if you have not purchased an investment property yet this year, and it's been one of your goals, I need you to listen very closely. I know many of you live in areas where it's so expensive and investment properties seem impossible. I'm talking about some of the big cities. So LA, New York City, maybe even Seattle, Atlanta, places in Florida, and the list goes on. If you know that where you live is too expensive, I need you to lock in right now. Investing out of state changed my life as somebody living in California. I now invest in Ohio and I'm growing my portfolio. It's something that's possible. You just need the right information and execution. So if that's you, if you want to learn how to invest out of state, go to outofstatemoney.com and there is a free training that'll outline the steps for you and help you understand exactly what it takes. So go to outofstatemoney.com or simply go to the link in the description of this episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, Episode 8. The purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming Black real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors. A couple of things I want to touch on before we get into this week's episode. First, for those who listened last week, you knew that I would be speaking at a real estate meetup, and that went really well. It was on Tuesday, and I spoke on a panel along with an investor who's based in New York City, Marcus Jackson. You can find him on Instagram at InvestWithMJ. It was a really wonderful night. There were about 25 to 30 people present, and we shared our stories, how we got started, financing, the challenges we went through. And for me, the best part of it was that, you know, we're two investors with different strategies, same goals, but different ways of going about it. And we've both been successful in taking this leap in real estate. He recently closed on a multifamily, I believe in New Jersey. So it was just inspiring hearing his story, hearing about the different things he did. And similar to me, he didn't have much experience, but you know, in a short period of time, he was able to figure things out and get in the game. So I was inspired by him, and I look forward to continuing to develop a relationship with that brother. And it was good. You know, everyone was exchanging information with one another throughout the night, asking good questions. So I believe a lot of people got great value out of the event. Everyone's network grew and expanded with like-minded individuals. And, you know, I just can't wait to see where everyone is at in the future. So shout out to my friend Serena for organizing such an amazing event and opening up her home to host the event and also including me and seeing fit that I will participate in the panel. So thank you so much, Serena. I truly do appreciate you. And I look forward to participating in more of these events. Something else that I would like to touch on is just the importance of business and exposing young children to business. And the reason that I'm mentioning that is because this weekend I was picking up some shea butter in Inglewood at a store called the Body Butter Lady, which is a Black-owned business that I go to for various things. And when I asked for what I wanted, something interesting happened. The owner's teenage daughter was the person who interacted with me, made sure I had what I needed, the size, all that good stuff. And at that moment, I thought to myself, she's going to be so far ahead in the future because of her exposure to her mother's business, just seeing the day-to-day, seeing how things are produced, working with customers. And I'm sure she's, you know, into the numbers and how much things cost to make and the price points to sell things at and so forth. And so for me, it's just a reminder that when it's my time to raise children, it's important for them to be aware of my entrepreneurial ventures so they too can have a leg up on the competition, a leg up on their peers in the future. Lastly, shout out to our show sponsors, Mint Inc. Mint stands for the Minority Interdisciplinary Networking Team. Mint empowers young minority professionals with an interdisciplinary network for learning, collaborating, and the development of entrepreneurial ventures. You can become a member of their network for free at mintinc-usa.com. You can also follow them on Instagram at mint_inc. Lastly, for our Apple users, we are now on Apple Podcasts as of about a week ago. Definitely subscribe, leave us ratings. That'll help us move up in the rankings. But definitely subscribe and you'll be alerted as soon as we drop a new episode. So very excited for this episode. Let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Here with me, I have Henry Washington, who's the owner of Independence Realty Group, and he's out of Northwest Arkansas. Henry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate you having me on the show today. Thank you.
Absolutely, absolutely. So first, Henry, tell us about what your childhood was like and what you saw or what you didn't see that shaped your view of building wealth.
Yeah, man. Childhood was great, man. I come from, my parents are both educated, college educated, both have master's degrees. And so they were very focused on ensuring that I got my education. Father and mother were both, my options after high school per my father were go to college or live with your mom. So I kind of knew from an early age that it was just ingrained in us that we were going to go to school. And so I got a traditional, school education, which didn't come with a lot of financial education. I went to school, got a degree, and got a job, the traditional route. I would say I didn't learn about financial education really just until a couple years ago. But I did have an entrepreneurial kind of seed planted because my father always had businesses on the side. He was a high school teacher. He's retired now. He taught art in high school, but when I was real young, he used to grow flowers in the backyard, pot them, and then go sell them at the swap meet. He owned an arcade, and so I was like the cool kid in the neighborhood because he had all these old refurbished arcade games in the garage. So everybody would come over and play arcade games. We owned a barbecue restaurant for about 10 years while I was growing up. And so I always saw that there was a different way to make money other than just having your job. But I don't think I really realized that it was something that I could do until recently. So that's kind of where the entrepreneurial spirit comes from, my father.
Definitely. That's awesome. I'm sure, as a kid, you don't really realize what you're seeing until it manifests itself in your life later on. So that's really cool that you're able to see your dad working, but also having a variety of businesses on the side. So that's really cool.
Thank you.
And what's your current career background?
Sure. So I went to school for computer information systems. And so I've spent most of my day job career in some form of IT management. I've done everything from helping build and develop software and implement that software to now for the past, I'd say 4 to 5 years, I've been focused on analytics, data analytics.
Nice. And why did you decide to get into real estate? Like, what was it that kind of sparked that in you? And it's like, this is how I'm going to go about building wealth.
Yeah, man. Panic, I'd say, is what got me into real estate. So my wife and I met and then got married 365 days after we met. And so I was used to being a single guy. And then, what seems like overnight, I was married and talking about starting a family. And I had no savings, man. I had $1,000 in a savings account. And then everything else was paycheck to paycheck. And, when you're a single guy, you don't really think about that much. But when you then realize you got a wife and she wants kids, and I was literally woke up panicking one night because I didn't know how I was going to take care of my family. And so I Googled literally at 2-3 in the morning, Googled passive income, right? How do I make passive income? And I just saw lots of videos and articles around real estate. And I thought to myself, man, I've always enjoyed real estate, or what I thought I knew of real estate at the time, which was, my wife and I would stop at open houses for no reason, right? Just to look at houses and talk about what we might want in a house. And so that piqued my interest. And I listened to a TED talk about passive income, and the gentleman who was speaking spoke about rental income, and then got a reference to Rich Dad, Poor Dad, read that book, and was hooked and realized, all right, this is something I know I can do. I'm just going to dive in head first. So So that's kind of what sparked my interest, and I've never looked back.
Definitely. So what was – walk us through your first deal. What was that like?
The first deal was cool, man. After reading Rich Dad Poor Dad and trying to figure it and learning, all right, I want to build a rental portfolio, I just decided to start telling people that I was a real estate investor and that I buy rental properties. I hadn't bought a single property, but what I decided I was going to tell people. And kind of what that led to was a good buddy of mine heard that I was buying rental properties, and he was like, hey man, I heard you're buying rentals. I got a house I need to sell. Are you interested? And I was like, yeah, I'm interested. I had no money to buy this house, but I told him I was interested. And so he was in a unique situation. So he had a house he used to live in. He moved out to live on like his church's campus in order to save money so that he could buy this property that the church I don't know if the church, somebody in the church owned. And so he was living to save money to buy this property. And he had finally got to the point where he was ready to purchase and couldn't get the type of loan that he needed to buy that house until he sold the house he used to live in. And what he had done was he just rented the house out to a buddy of his, just at what it cost for the mortgage. Cause this gentleman was trying to then fix his credit up so he could buy the house. And you know how that story goes, you know, he never got to that point. And when it got time for him to have to get rid of the house, he couldn't sell it to this guy and was kind of in a pinch. And so he said, hey, you know, I need to sell it. I'll sell it to you for a good price. And I looked at it and I ran the numbers. I mean, I knew where it was because I'd been there before, and I ran the numbers, and it worked. It worked from a rental perspective. And so I said, yeah, I'll buy it. And I put it under contract, and then had to figure out how I was going to finance it with no money. So from that point, I freaked out. And you know, I went through the motions. I was like, what can I sell? You know, who can I borrow money from? Right. And I was coming up empty on everything. And so I had kind of gotten to a point where I was like, all right, I'm going to have to tell this guy I can't buy it. So I called a good buddy of mine who actually ended up being my business partner later on. And I said, hey man, I've got a good deal. I want to buy it. I can't buy it because I don't have any money, but you should buy it because he really needs some help. And, you know, I kind of got my first taste of like, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you need to think differently. And he said, I could buy it and I will buy it, but you need to figure out how to buy this. Go figure it out. Don't stop until you figure out a way. And so we brainstormed on the phone and kind of came across 401k loans, right? And I was like, well, my wife has a 401k. I did not. I have a supportive wife. Was a much better planner before than me at a younger age. And so we looked into that, and we were able to leverage her 401k to take the loan out for the down payment. So we took about 20 grand out of her 401k. Put it on the down payment, bought the house, kept the same guy in it, raised his rent to market rates, and the cash flow from that deal is enough to pay all the expenses and pay back the 401k, which is essentially paying ourselves back with interest. So
right.
That works well. So yeah, man, that's kind of how it got started, and I got hooked because it all just kind of worked out well, and somebody was paying me to live in my house and pay back the loan that I got to buy the house.
Definitely. There are a couple of things I want to touch on from what you explained. So first is that you said what you wanted to be to others before you even did it. So right. Like I buy houses, I'm a real estate investor before you even had a property. And because of that, and you were telling people about it. And because of that, you were able to get your first deal. You know, when people thought about you, they thought, okay, he buys houses. Now, you didn't have the money for it, but you figured it out. You know, you got something under contract and you just figured it out, you know. And what I've seen is a lot of people are afraid to kind of just take that bold step. I mean, sometimes, you know, you have to be crazy enough to believe it and take a step forward and, you know, and just figure it out and let it grow from there. So that's really awesome. And it's good that you had a supportive wife as well.
That's the key. That's the key, folks. Stop some more.
Definitely. And how much? I'm not familiar with the Arkansas market. How much was that first property?
Sure. Yeah. So the purchase price was $115,000. It was a 3-bed, 2-bath, all brick ranch house, about 1,300 square feet. In a good neighborhood, in good shape. And so, that's a pretty good price for that type of home in this area, right? And so at the time I bought it, the house appraised for 140 to 145, if I remember correctly, and I bought it for 115, and it's appreciated now. A couple of years later, it's worth about 150 to 155. So, still own it. The original tenant just moved out this past month, and so I'm doing a few light upgrades to it right now, and we're going to get somebody in there. So we had raised his rent to $1,100, and he stayed there paying $1,100, and I plan to ask $1,200 to $1,300 now once I get this light remodel done with it.
Cool. Cool. And how many rental units do you have now?
Sure. I think I'm somewhere close to 40 doors. And I would say a little over half of those doors, I think I have 12 to myself. The rest are in a partnership, 50-50 partnership with the gentleman who told me figure out a way to buy it. So he and I started a partnership almost 2 years ago, and we've accumulated quite a portfolio for ourselves as well.
Wow. So you're at 40 doors in 2.5-3 years?
Two years, man.
Two plus years.
Yeah, just over 2 years.
Wow. So talk to us more about that. How do you go from one to 40 in 2 years? How did that work out for you? that's remarkable.
Yeah, so the way that kind of worked was, so after I bought that first rental, I started marketing to find more, and I started doing direct mail marketing. And so through my first direct mail marketing campaign, I sent 1,000 postcards, and I got, I think I got 2 deals out of those. And so what happened was, I would find some deals, and then I would take the gentleman I was talking about. He'd go with me. He'd look at him. He's got more of a construction background. His name is Dustin, so I can just refer to him as Dustin going forward. So I would take Dustin with me, and he had a construction background, so he kind of knew what to look for as I was walking properties and would kind of help me from that perspective. And then, as I was walking these properties, he'd say, well, I'd buy this one. And so that's kind of how we worked out the first couple of deals is, I was finding them and he was buying them. After about 3 deals like that, he said, maybe we should go into business together because I'm tired of spending my money on deals. And so we formed a partnership and we started splitting the marketing cost. And what that did was it allowed us to market more. So I went from sending 1,000 postcards a month. I think we got up to 8,000 postcards a month when we were really doing heavy marketing, because we had 2 people, 2 people's, effort was more than what I could do on my own. And we kind of split it up in a way that made sense for us. And man, it really helped us grow. And so what we were doing, I think the way we were able to grow so fast is our focus was on finding a good deal, right? We knew that if we could find a good deal, that we could figure out a way to make money on it. So every deal we found that was good, we would make money on it. And so sometimes we'd buy a deal and figure out what that property was going to be after we bought it, because it was just a good deal. And so what that allowed us to do was some of these properties we flipped, right? Some of these properties we sent to other investors, right? It just depended on where we were from a capital standpoint and what we could do with it. But because we were flipping these deals, what we would do is we'd flip them, use the capital to buy the ones that were really good deals and hold those. And so that's kind of how we grew. At the same time, as we were marketing, I found a flip through word of mouth again, just from telling people what I was doing. I found a great deal on a flip and was able to cash out on that flip, which gave me a good chunk of change to do some more buy and holds. So, you know, I would tell people, man, no matter what your strategy is, like no matter what you think you want to do, if you want to wholesale, if you want to flip houses, if you want to do rental properties, the one common denominator that you need is a good deal, right? So spend your time and energy and your resources that you have to finding a good deal, right? Because once you get that good deal on the hook, you're going to be motivated to figure out the rest of the steps to buy that deal or to wholesale that deal or to flip that deal. That's really the key to success in real estate is the deal, right? So yeah, man, leverage is how we kind of grew and just focused on finding good deals, and whatever situation we were in at the moment, we would pick a strategy.
Definitely. And what's your personal criteria for figuring out if something's a good deal?
Sure. So for us, man, so for me, I'm looking for, I want to be able to, if it's a hold, if it's a single family hold, I want it to pay me like a multifamily. So if it's a single family, I want $200 a door after all the expenses. If it's a multifamily, I want $100 a door after all the expenses. Now, I'll take a little less per door the more doors there are, right? So, you know, I'm not gonna frown my nose at $80 a door on a, you know, 20 or 30 unit, right? Just because it doesn't hit the $100 a door. But those rules of thumb we like to follow. So about $100 a door. For a flip, man, you know, traditional, we're looking at 70% of market value minus repairs. I know if I can buy at 70% of market value minus repairs, I can make money on it, whether I keep it or send it to another investor or flip it, you know. So we kind of stick to those rules of thumbs, and then we'll bend them a little bit depending on the location, right? Location is key, right? So if it's in a prime location, I might pay a little more than 70%. If it's in not so great, 70% may not be enough, right? I may need more than 70% market value minus repair. So, you know, just I use those rules of thumb just as rules of thumb. And then the other factors play into which side of that equation I end up on.
Definitely. So after your first deal, did you start kind of sourcing deals for Dustin? And then after a while, you were kind of like, let's do this together. Is that how the trajectory went?
In a nutshell, that's about how it went. After that first deal, I started marketing and I found that first flip kind of at the same time.
Got it.
And, that first flip was pretty unique in that it was such a good deal that the bank lent me all the money. So they lent me 85% plus they lent me the down payment. So they kind of financed the whole deal, but they didn't give me enough renovation money to do the project. And so I then turned to a private lender, which happened to be Dustin at the time. He had a line of credit that he had access to. And so I said, hey, can you loan me the rest of the money that I need? And I'll pay you, I think we paid him 10 or 11% interest on that money. And so he lent me the rest. And so I had no money out of pocket on this flip. So the numbers on this flip were, I paid 190, it appraised as is at 240. And then we put 40,000 into it and sold it for 325, I believe, is what the sale price was. So, you know, no money in and made a pretty good profit on that deal, which gave us a cash that we could put into the rentals.
Definitely. How did you make your way into flipping? Was it kind of intuitive or was it part of the plan, or did you kind of get it and say, maybe I could flip this?
Yeah. So I look at everything from a rental lens first, right? Cause that's my bread and butter, is I'm trying to build a rental portfolio. When I got the lead on this deal as a rental, it just didn't work, right? It was too big. So I knew I either had to flip it or do a live-in flip, were the exit strategies for this one. And it was just a diamond in the rough, man. It was in a super desirable neighborhood out here, out in Fayetteville. And I just knew that this one had to be a flip because the market was there for it. The demand was there for that property. I mean, I sold that property for sale by owner in 2 days.
Wow.
After I was done with it. And the buyer didn't have a realtor either. So I was really able to capitalize on a good return on that one. It's one of those deals, man, where it's like, it's your first flip, so it's great, but it's not so great, because I had then an expectation that they were all going to be like this, and I haven't found another one that sweet since.
Right. Definitely. So it sounds like that one kind of got the ball rolling and yep. was able to fund the future deals. Just another question regarding the flips. So just being so new to it, how did you manage like contractors, budget, and all those? Like, what did that look like for someone who was so green to that particular method?
It didn't look awesome.
Tell us more.
I didn't want that to stop me. So yeah, so I knew that deal needed quite a bit of work. And so I needed a contractor, didn't have one. And so my strategy for finding a contractor was, I would just stop. Every time I saw somebody rehabbing a property, I would stop and ask who the contractor was. And so there was a house not far from where we were living at the time that I saw being renovated. And so I stopped in one day when I saw somebody there, and I just asked, I said, hey, you know, are you the contractor? And he said, yeah. I said, cool. Are you the homeowner? And he said, yeah. And I said, do you do more than just your own stuff? And he said, absolutely. He said, you want to take a look? Come inside. And so this man invited me into his home where he was working on the renovations, right? His family was in there. And, you know, I'm just a guy that pulled up off the street, right?
Yeah.
And, no, but I like that. I like that he was like, yeah, man, come in, take a look. Look at my work. I'm willing to do more work. And here's the quality of my work. And I stand by it because my family's living here, right? And so I really liked that about him. And he then came out the next day, looked at the project, and gave me a bid. And I had gotten bids from several contractors, some of which I found through the local RIA that I was a part of, and some of which I just found through doing some Googling. And the reason I picked the gentleman that I picked was, A, he walked me through his house and his family was there. B, he was willing to put his skin in the game. So the way he worked, he said, you don't pay me a dime until the job is done and you say I did the job, right? So he fronted the cost on the front side. And so for a new investor, man, that's huge, because I was so worried about a contractor walking away with my money, right? And I didn't have that risk with this guy. So worked out great. Spent a little more than the bid originally asked, but like I said, he had skin in the game, so I was okay with that. And then it worked out well. He got paid when I got paid. He got paid at the closing table.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so it seemed like, you know, it was pretty smooth once you got him, and you know, things went fairly smoothly as far as like the relationship.
Yeah, so I learned some lessons, right? And so I kind of walked him through and talked through what I wanted to do. And then kind of as he was working, some of those things that I wanted to do weren't getting done. And some of those things that I wanted to do were getting done, but not at the level that I wanted. And so, you know, the lessons I learned. Now I still work with this guy. And so what I do is I walk through and I do a room by room scope of work before the project, right? So I write down every room. These are the things that I want done, right? Paint colors, finishes, right? It's at a high level, but it's still, at least gives him a room by room. So there's less questions at the end, or like, I didn't quite remember what you said when we did that walkthrough. And so I do that room by room scope of work on the front side, and I send that to contractors now before they come see the project, because I want them to know ahead of time kind of what's the size of the prize for them, right? That's been super helpful. some contractors I do use now do require a deposit or a down payment, right? And kind of what I've learned through that is I'm great giving a deposit, right? But I want to know, like, what part of the scope of work is that deposit going to, right? So I know on the front that I'm giving you a, you know, 30, 40% deposit. Here are the line items that that deposit's going to go to. That's something I learned, learned the hard way. I didn't get burned not doing that on the front side, but I had a lot of questions about the work that was done. Cause when they would come back and ask for their next draw, right, I said, well, I already gave you X, Y, and Z. What did that go to? And so now I just kind of get that lined out on the front side. I said, hey, I'm giving you a, you know, 40% deposit. Just show me the scope of work, where that's going, so that when you're asking for the next draw, I can kind of check it off and say, okay, I'm ready to give you that.
Makes sense. What I really like is the fact that you just took lessons from each experience and just use it to kind of grow and refine how you dealt with contractors and how you move the work along. So I believe that's very valuable.
Yeah. You know, I know that I have a higher risk tolerance than maybe some others who are kind of getting into this. And I've always taken like a ready, fire, aim approach, and sure, man, that's burned me sometimes and it's benefited me sometimes. I am a people person. I'm a relationship person. So I leverage my relationships first and then structure second. And that might not be for everybody, right? I feel like if I have a good relationship, that's going to benefit me more than all the dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And so people need to decide what kind of approach they want to take. Like, I'm okay taking that risk because I feel the benefits of a good relationship are going to benefit me more than being such a stickler on the exact numbers and budget.
Definitely. Awesome. So that flip into the rest of the properties. One thing that I don't know too much about, and perhaps those listening as well, you know, some so used to kind of, you know, typical going through agents and things of that nature. Can you talk to us more about direct mailing? How does that work? How do you figure out who to mail and say, I want to buy your house? How does that whole thing work?
Yeah. Direct mail has been great. So for me, I took the approach of, there's a lot of people that have been doing direct mail. And so learning a lot of lessons from people who have done it. So I did a lot of reading blogs and watching YouTube videos from people that had done it. And kind of the approach I took was I said, all right, I know I want to send direct mail. I know what cities I want to send direct mail in. And, but I didn't know like what kind of motivated sellers I wanted to look for. And so my approach at the time when I was starting out with was, listen to who everybody else was mailing and see if that made sense for me. And so what I saw was there was tons of people mailing absentees. And so I said, great, I don't want to do that, right? I don't want to mail absentees strictly because I felt like if people in my area were doing that, I didn't want my piece of mail to be their fifth or sixth piece of mail. I either want to be their first or I want to be their last, right? I want to be that the first time they see something and kind of spark the idea of, oh, well, okay, I might be interested in selling, or be the last piece of mail that they get from somebody. And so kind of the way I did that was I just tried to think of who might be motivated in my area that wasn't absentee. And so I went for an age demographic. So I looked for people who, you know, may have had, so for me, age was my good way of reaching people who might have equity and people who might not want to fix up their place anymore. And so that worked out well for me. I got a good return. One of the quick lessons I learned was I sent 1,000 pieces of mail. I sent them all at once and my phone went crazy, both with people who were interested and people who were not interested. And so, you know, I learned quickly to break that up. So I would send 250 a week, right, to kind of hit that number I was looking for. You know, if you're doing this full time and you can take the phone calls, man, I'd say spend as much as your budget will allow and mail as many as you can, right? For me, having a day job, you know, that many phone calls at one time was too much to handle. I couldn't answer all the calls. And I feel like answering the phone is huge. That's a big plus for me as well, is answering all the calls. Some people do, they do voicemail only, right? Leave a message, I'll call you back. Or some people have a VA answering the phone that isn't local. Kind of what I found is sometimes people ask me, the first question they ask me is, you know, where are you at, right? And if I don't say that I'm local, you know, they tune out, right? And so they kind of like the fact that, hey, yeah, I live here. I sent you mail. I want to buy your house. I know the area. Like, when I get to your house, it's me. I'm the person you talk to. And so I feel like that's a benefit for me as well. So I would encourage people to do that, man. Answer the phone and then go show up, right? And it builds a lot of credibility pretty quickly.
Definitely.
Other lessons I've learned, man, is persistence, man. I would mail people 6 or 7 times, and I got several leads where it's like, hey, man, I've been getting your letter for 5 months now. Tell me what this is all about, right? And so I've gotten leads that way. So I'd say if you're going to do direct mail, then, you know, figure out where you want to buy, figure out who you want to mail, and just stick with it, right? The first time it might be successful, it might not, but persistence will pay off and you'll start to get those leads. And you need to realize that, yeah, you're going to spend some money on the front side, but one deal is going to pay you back, right? So just stick with it.
Definitely, definitely. And how did you find out the age information? When you say age, you mean the age of the occupant or the house?
Yeah, the age of the occupant, right? The age of the owner. I think we used Experian, one of the credit bureaus, to build our list. I used them because they were cheaper, right, than ListStores. And when I was just getting started, I needed the cheapest possible way to get leads that wasn't going to take a ton of time. And so we used that. And yeah, you were able to filter on tons of different criteria. And so, yeah, I was looking for older occupants.
Definitely.
And I've since switched and used ListSource now. Most people doing direct mail use ListSource, and it's more expensive, but the data was a little more credible, I found, than the credit bureau source, right? So when I was first getting started, I would spend the time to kind of, play with the list after I download it to kind of filter out what I didn't want. And now that I've kind of got it honed in a little more and have a little more capital to play with, I'm willing to pay more for a better ListSource.
Definitely, definitely. And did you use one of those apps to put the mailings together? Like the templates and stuff? Did you write them?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I still don't. I found a local. So what I did was I had a coworker whose mother owned a t-shirt print shop, right? And so I knew that they were printing signs and t-shirts and mailing them to people. And so I said, hey, will your mom send mail? And she was like, I don't know, ask her. And so she gave me her mom's contact, and I called her and I said, hey, I work with your daughter. Would you send mail for me? And she was like, yeah. And so I said, well, here's kind of what I'm thinking about. Like, I'll get you a list. I want to send some postcards. Here's generally what I want them to say. Would you be willing to do that and tell me how much? And she took my information that I wanted and within a couple of hours sent me a proof of like, here, do you want your postcard to look something like this? And I was like, yeah, that'll be great. And she said, cool, I'll do it for X, Y, and Z price. And that's what I've been doing ever since. And I like the fact that she's local and, you know, somebody I can just call up and make tweaks to the mailer if I need to. And she's even adjusted her price to kind of compete with some of the larger, you know, mailing companies out there, as I've done some search. And I said, hey, this is what I could get with this company. Would you be willing? And she, yeah, I'll do that. And so it's been good for me. And so I'd say, yeah, man, if you don't be afraid to just ask somebody what they'll do and what they won't do. I know there's a lot of these services that'll send mail for you. And what I found was I did a campaign through one of those online services to kind of compare. And their price was great, but their timing wasn't right? I sent them a list and the mail didn't go out for 4 weeks, right? And I just didn't want that kind of lag. And with the people I'm using locally, I send them a list and a couple of days later, my phone's ringing. So they're, figure out what works for you. You know, it may make sense for you to use a large third party to do it, or, you know, there might be somebody in your own backyard that's willing to send mail.
Definitely. That's awesome. So to get to like the 40 doors, how are the deals financed? How does that scale so fast? Mm-hmm. I know you got the initial capital from the flips, but I guess ongoing, how did things progress from there?
Yeah. I've used small regional banks for almost everything. And the rest that I didn't use small regional banks for were owner finance deals. So, I went around to a couple of banks that had people coming to the RIA, and I told them what I was looking to do, and they said, yeah, when you get a deal, send it to me. And so that's what I did, is I sent them the deals, and they hit me back with their terms. They said, hey, we'll finance it at this. And so the small regional banks have been super flexible and easy to work with here, and that's what I've done the majority of my deals with. I think there's four banks that I work with here now. And so when I get a deal, I've got my favorites and I'll send it to them, and then and they'll give me their terms. And if I don't like those, I'll send it to a couple of more. And, once you get through the rigmarole of them vetting your finances and knowing what they will lend to you, they can move pretty quick. And so I've closed on properties in 2 weeks with bank financing.
Wow.
I think if for someone looking to get started, yeah, call those small regional banks, ask them kind of what their normal terms are, and then ask them, if they'll do in-house appraisals. Because what I found is the banks that can do in-house appraisals can move a lot quicker for you. So that will allow you to kind of give you the leg up in your market. Right. You know, hey, Mr. Seller, I can close within 2 weeks because you know your bank can do an in-house appraisal, because the appraisal is usually the step that takes the longest. And if they can do it in 15, 20 minutes on a computer in the bank, then you can close quickly. And they're usually cheaper. The in-house appraisals are usually cheaper. That works well with single families and duplexes, not so much with tries and things, triplexes and things that don't have a lot of comps, because then those small regional banks are going to probably lean on a third party appraisal for those things.
Definitely. So a couple questions. So I recently learned about owner financing. Can you talk to us more about how that works and how you get an owner to agree to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see, I've got five doors that are owner financed, two separate deals. So the way it kind of works is if you find a lead on something and you know that it's owned free and clear, and the way you can figure that out is just ask. Most people will tell you, right? So kind of when I'm vetting a lead, one of the key questions I ask is, other than how much do you want for it, always ask what they want for it, right? Because a lot of people will just tell you, here's the number I want, right? And you can kind of get a good sense for if this is going to be a good deal for you or if they're willing to negotiate right up front. So I'd say always ask what they want for the property, and then ask them. Sometimes the way we get to it is I ask them, if you sell it, and I know they own it, I say, if you sell it, what are you going to do with the money? And if they say, I'm just going to, throw it in savings, right? Then I'll say, I'll ask them, what if I could give you a better return on that money than you're going to get in the bank and keep you from paying the taxes on the front side, right? And if they sound interested, then I'll kind of talk through what that structure looks like. Sometimes it's just about like solving their needs. So one of them, they said they owned them free and clear and they liked the cash flow, but they were just tired of managing them. And I said, and so this was with my partner and I, so we said, well, what if we could keep keep you getting the cash flow, right, without you having to deal with the hassle? And they said, well, we'd be interested in that. And so we just from there put together three or four different terms, sets of terms for them, right, and presented the terms and said, hey, you know, we want to buy it, right? Which one of these sets of terms works for you, right? And when you word the question like that, where it says, which one of these works for you, you know, then they look at those options and potentially pick one, right? And if they say none of them, then we talk about, okay, well, we can do some more traditional financing for these types of deals. So it's just, man, it's simply just ask. If you know they own it or if you know they own the majority of it, ask them. Say, hey, would you be willing to, you know, what if you could continue to make the kind of money you're making on this property and never have to worry about a phone call or a tenant again? And most of the time they'll say, yeah, that sounds good, right? And then even if they say, hey, no, I need money to pay for X, Y, and Z, then we even might structure it to say, well, hey, what if we can give you a good chunk of that as a down payment, right? And then have you carry the rest and make a little bit of interest. So you just can't be afraid to ask, man. If they say no, they say no. But you know, the few deals we've done that have been owner financed, those are our some of our best cash flowing assets. So, man, absolutely ask. Download yourself just like an amortization table, right? Where you can plug and play with some numbers and do like a printout and show them, right? So we'll take them an amortization table and say, hey, this is what we can pay you, right? Principal and interest. And then, you know, and then we can kind of play with those numbers and we'll present multiple options. We might do a, you know, 10% down, right? Here's what your payments would look like. 20% down, play with the interest rate a little bit. So we've done things like that.
For sure. Definitely. Can you walk us through, say one of them, like just roughly what the terms look like, the financing looks like, mm-hmm. cash flow, and all those things. Owner finance deals, yeah.
Yep. So the last one we did was a duplex. And so, so what we did was we said, hey, we can do traditional financing, right? And here's the money you're looking to make, right? And here's, you know, potentially what you're looking to pay from a tax perspective, right? So, so what we did was we sent him some owner finance options, and I think what we landed on was we paid him $121,000 for the duplex. He was in a situation where he needed, I think, $8,000. He was purchasing something for one of his kids, and that's what he needed cash for. And so I said, we'll give you $10,000 down. That'll allow you to buy what you need. I'll give you a couple extra thousand in your pocket. He was most concerned about kind of how much money he would get monthly. And so we kind of tweaked the numbers on amortization and interest rate to make sure that he got that monthly payment he was looking for to make him feel comfortable with the deal. So we knew he wanted about $600 a month, right? And so we just tweaked the numbers. And so I think we landed on a 20-year amortization schedule with a 4% interest rate that kind of gave him the monthly payment that he was looking for. He was totally happy with that deal. We gave him $10,000 and we closed that in like a week.
Wow.
Because it was owner financed. Look for, try to figure out what your sellers are wanting, right? Because if they're, you know, sometimes they've owned these properties for so long and their rents are so low, you're able to say, hey, what if I could pay you exactly what you're getting paid now from the rents without ever having to deal with another tenant because their rents are low? And that could just turn those into your monthly payment. And you might even get a deal that there's no interest rate, right? Because you could just say, hey, you're making $600 a month on this. What if I could pay you $600 a month? And if they're okay with that, then you work out a term that's $600 a month with no interest, and then you're paying all principal.
Wow. And did you raise the rent on that one?
We did. Yes. So that one we did. That one we raised the rents. They were paying $400 a month per side, and I think $500 a month per side. And we raised rents to $725 on one side and $700 on the other. Is what we raised rents to there.
Wow. What's the cash flow on that one?
Yeah. So we're paying this guy, about, I think it ended up being $564 was where the payment landed. Right. And so, we're getting $1,400 and some change, out of that one. So cash flow's great on that one. Taxes are fairly low because it's a 2-bed, 1-bath, I think 800 square foot per side. It's not very big. So the taxes aren't that heavy. Mortgage payments low. We budget some for maintenance, repairs, and vacancy. And we're great with that one.
Wow. That's really cool. That's like the first time I've received like a full explanation of what that could look like. I mean, I think it's great. It's mutually beneficial for both parties because, you know, if someone owns it free and clear, and now they could, you know, make close to whatever they were making, managing the whole thing. There's no bank. You're doing it directly. The down payment is very low, and the cash flow is great. So, I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome.
With that one, so kind of he wasn't even thinking owner finance. You know, he just wanted us to buy it.
Yeah.
And when I asked him what he was going to do with the money, he said, well, I got to spend about $8,000 on this gift I'm purchasing. But, you know, other than that, I was going to throw it in savings. And I said, well, you're going to pay a hefty chunk of taxes on that come tax time. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, you know, we could find a way to still get you your $8,000 and keep you from paying a bunch of taxes. And he said, well, let me know what that looks like. And I'll talk to my tax guy. And that's exactly what he did. Is I said, hey, go ask him and say, hey, if you sell it, how much taxes are you going to have to pay versus if you do this owner finance option? And he did. He called his tax guy and he called me the next day and he said, hey, I think we're going to do one of those owner finance options. I said, okay, we can work something like that out, right? When he had to, once he heard the number of what he would have to pay if he sold it.
Definitely. And so for the other deals, when you say financing, do you mean like you did like a traditional 20% down, or you did like a cash out refinance? Like which one?
Sure. So I'll talk you through what a flip loan looks like, and then kind of what a buy and hold loan looks like with traditional bank financing for me. So for flips, I've got two options with the banks. So three of the banks that I work with do, they'll loan me 85%, right? And then I've got to come up with 15% of purchase price. So what that means is they'll loan me 85% of the purchase and then 100% of the rehab, right? And so if I go to them and I say, hey, I've got a deal, let's just use some numbers. For example, if I go to them and say, hey, I've got a house, it's going to cost me $50,000 to purchase it, and I need $20,000 for the rehab, right? They'll loan me 85% of that $50,000 and then 100% of that $20,000 for the rehab. So I know I need to come up with 15% of that $50,000 as a down payment, right? And so that's traditionally what it's going to cost me. And so what I do for flips is I've got a couple of friends, business partners that I've met over the couple of years I've been doing this that have, you know, $10,000-$15,000 in a savings account. And I'll go to them and say, hey, I'm going to buy this house. I'm going to put $20,000 into it. I need 15% down payment. If you'll loan me that 15% down payment, I'll pay you $1,000 when I'm done, right? And so they make $1,000 on their money that was just sitting in the bank. I get complete 100% financing because I've got the bank loaning me the money for the purchase and the rehab, and then I borrow the down payment money from this other investor. So I'm no money in to do a flip. And then when I sell it, the bank obviously gets their money. And then I pay them, I pay my lender back 50% down payment. With that, you know, it's usually somewhere between $600 to $1,000. So I call it like a thank you fee for letting me borrow the money. So
wow,
essentially what a flip looks like for me, I won't have any money in. I also have another bank that'll loan me 100% financing for the flip. So, but the catch with that is I'm paying, when I borrow 100% of the money for the rehab and the purchase, they want me to pay my payments to be principal and interest the whole time. So the other deal I was talking about, I'm making interest-only payments while I'm doing the rehab. And then when you sell the house, you kind of pay it all back. So your payments are cheaper when you're putting a down payment in. This other loan where I'm not putting a down payment in, my payments are higher. So I only want to use that type of loan on projects I know I'm going to turn around quickly, right? If you don't, your holding costs are I limit my holding costs that way. So for rentals, what I like to do is, it's the same. They'll loan me 85% of the purchase price, or 85% of the purchase price, 100% of the rehab. But I can't borrow the down payment there because it's a rental and I'm going to keep it for a long period of time. So I got to use my own capital for that 15%. So I'll put that 15% in and I'll rehab the house. I'll get the renters in. I'll get the rents up. And then I'll refinance that house to pull my down payment back out. Sometimes I'll pull more than my down payment if I bought it super great. Right. Great price. Then there's enough room for me to refinance it and pull everything back out. But most of the time, I just try to pull my down payments back out. And so that's the BRRRR method that people talk about, is refinancing it, pulling your down payment back out, and then going to buy another one.
Got it. So it makes sense. So you've essentially, for the most part, just repeated the BRRRR method, and that's helped you both to scale this rapidly.
Repeating the BRRRR and then finding a way to finance 100% of my flips, right? So essentially can do as many flips as I want because it's not costing me any money to do a flip. Right. I make money and then I can take that money and buy more rentals.
Got it. So a combination of flips and BRRRR. I think that's incredible. So how do you get, so for me, the way you explained it, so if I had 15,000 in the bank and, you know, in a couple months or long, and you had $600 to $1,000, that seems good to me. But how do you get people to agree to that? Was it hard for you? Or did you just find, you know, the right friend or colleague that trusted you and was down for it?
Yeah, man. Again, it's that methodology of I tell everyone what I do, right? Everyone all the time. And what you'll find as a real estate investor is everybody at some point has wanted to do what you're doing, right? They just might not have been able to get over the fear or the risk involved, right? But they've thought about it. And so when you're telling them what you do, and then you can show them that you've done it a couple times to be successful, it's become a little easier. So it's mainly been two people that I've used to do this. One was the realtor that we were using to sell our properties at first. He had a big chunk of cash in there, and he kind of approached us and was like, hey man, if you need some money to do, you know, a down payment or something, let me know. I'd be glad to loan you a down payment. Cause he was selling the flips. So he saw the end product, right? He saw how long it took us to go from buying it to selling it. Right. He saw that buyers are buying them quickly. And he was like, I can help these guys by keeping their cash out of the deal and help me by, you know, making some extra money on top of the commission I'm making. So that's what really kind of opened my eyes to it. And so I ended up having a conversation just by happenstance with a friend that I grew up with who moved. So she relocated for work and ended up with a chunk of change from selling her old house where she used to live. And then where she bought was a smaller, not as expensive of a market. And so had this kind of chunk of change. And I said, hey, what are you going to do with that? she was like, oh, I'm probably just going to put it in savings and invest it. And I said, well, I could give you a pretty good return, right? And I explained to her the process, and she was like, I'm all in for that. And so we did one, and I did so good on that house, ended up paying her a little extra because it just worked out well. And I thought, if I give her a little extra, it might incentivize her to keep doing this with me. So I paid her a little extra. And then she was like, great, when's the next one? And I was like, cool, right now. And so I did another one. We just literally took that same money and she gave it back to me again. And I did another deal. And wow. Then she got paid again. And then we did it one more time. And so now it's three deals with her. I'd say she's made close to $3,000 for doing nothing, right? And it's helped me scale.
Wow, that's awesome. That's awesome. That's crazy. You know, you work with the realtor and they're calling you asking if they can give you money. Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
That's awesome. I really, the theme that I've gathered throughout this whole interview is that you haven't been afraid to tell people about what you're doing. And I think, you know, especially for our people, we get timid. I don't think it's humility. We get very timid about sharing our successes, sharing the great things that we're doing, because we don't want to come off like we're showing off or we're trying to, you know, I'm the man type of thing. But you're just sharing out of your excitement, and I'm sure it encourages others as well. And, yeah, you know, yeah. That's kind of something I've worked on too, because I just bought my first, I just closed my first deal a few weeks ago. And for me, it's a lot of people I was afraid to tell, but when I started speaking about it, people start asking you questions, people engage, like people want to talk about it. So that's an encouragement for me to just continue to talk about it, because you're not showing off, you're sharing about the great things you're doing, and you could be talking to the person, you know, I could be talking to someone who's going to fund my next deal, or who's going to partner with me or be a capital partner. You never know. And I think you, which you've spoken about it, and all these doors have opened, all these partnerships and, you know, things that just come together for you. So that's incredible.
That's it, man. Tell, you know, don't be afraid to tell people what you do, because you never know how they might benefit your business, or you never know what kind of impact you could have on them, even if they're just starting out. Like, I talk to people all the time who are just starting out, right? And part of the reason I do that is I just love talking real estate. But another reason I love doing that is because 2 years ago, I had $1,000 in my savings. I was doing nothing, right? And then now I'm in a position to help other people. And so I never know who I'm talking to. I could be talking to somebody who's doing their first deal today, and then tomorrow I'm going to need to go to them because I need their help, right? Because I need to borrow some of their money from all their success. So yeah, man, just tell everybody what you're doing. And man, just, you know, watch the process unfold. It's a great journey, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And do you self-manage, or
yes,
do you have a property manager?
Yeah, no, I self-manage. At some point I won't. But for right now, just with all the online tools and resources that are out there, it's easy to self-manage locally. If you're not investing in your market, that's a whole lot harder, but everything I own, I can drive to in 10 to 15 minutes. So, yeah, I self-manage, and I just enjoy it right now too. Because like I said, for me, it's a people business, man. The best part about this business has been just the people that I get to interact with. And so I enjoy self-managing. I enjoy interviewing tenants. I enjoy, you know, selecting tenants. Yeah, so no, I absolutely do it all. And at some point I'll get to a volume where I don't want to do that anymore. But a key to that too is always, always, always budget for property management. Your numbers need to work as if you're going to have a property manager, right? Because you want to think for success. And if you're going to be successful, right, and have a ton of properties, you're not always going to want to manage them. And you don't want to go broke when you end up having to manage them. Definitely. Or having to have somebody else manage them.
Definitely, definitely. And do you manage all of them? Do you split some of them up with your business partner? How does that work for you two?
Yeah. So we manage them all. We just, you know, he lives in one part of the area. I live in another. So the way it kind of works out for us is if it's closer to him, he'll deal with finding a tenant and getting it rented out. And if it's closer to me, I usually do it.
Definitely.
But yeah, man, we all self-manage. And then the tool we use for applications and all that, just we both log into it. And so we, you know, as we're selecting tenants, we both have to agree that that's who we want to pick. Only one of us may meet them, but we'll have a conversation about it and we'll review everything separately.
Definitely. And what tools and resources do you use just to stay organized with tenant requests, with rent, all those kind of things? I can imagine with, you know, 40 units, it's a lot to keep up with at times.
So we use Cozy for property management, cozy.co, which is great. It's free. And all of our tenants have to apply on there and they all have to pay their rent in there. And that just kind of keeps it all in one place. There's also even a portal for like maintenance requests, and we ask them to go in there if something breaks, just kind of fill it out in there, so there's always a record of it. So yeah, Cozy for most property management things. Everything else that's outside of property management, Google Docs sometimes.
Definitely. And so where do you go from here? You have 40 now in such a short time. What are the next couple of years look like for you? What are you anticipating?
Yeah, man, I'm looking to grow. So I've kind of shifted my marketing. I still market for single families because I like the flipping aspect of those. But most of my buy and holds I'm looking for are small to mid-sized multifamilies. So I'm now marketing for small apartment complexes and the storage facilities. I'm looking to expand into the commercial side and do some storage facilities. I'm kind of working or chatting one-on-one with a buddy of mine who's solely into storage facilities. And so that's a big interest of mine. So yeah, I'm looking to continue to grow my doors and to do it with multifamilies. I need money, so that's part of the reason for more networking and kind of expanding my network on the business side, is because I need the capital to do that.
Definitely. And what would you say, just a ballpark, is like the estimated cash flow from with all the properties together?
Oh man, after expenses?
Yeah, after expenses.
Goodness. I should have been prepared for that.
Ballpark is fine.
I don't. Yeah, ballpark it. I'd say at 40 doors, I'd say I'd average 100 to 150 a door. I'd say that's a safe bet. So, you know, it's not a ton of cash flow after expenses, man, but it's the long game.
Absolutely. I mean, that's already 4,000 or so bucks a month in a year. Yeah. I'd say that's pretty good. When you think about it, 10 years, there's no telling what it's going to be. So
yeah, absolutely, man. And then, you know, you're getting that appreciation and debt pay down all at the same time, and tax depreciation, man. It's the power of real estate is in more than just the cash flow. There's all these other benefits too. Right. So, you know, I tell people, you know, don't think you're going slow and not getting the benefits that you originally thought about, man. It's you got to think about the appreciation in the market, the depreciation that your taxes will allow you to take, right? And then the debt paid down, right? If you look at a rental property, right? If somebody came to you today and said, hey, I would love to pay your electric bill and then give you an extra 25 bucks on top of you paying your electric bill, you'd be all in for it, right? And that's essentially what a rental house is somebody saying, hey, I'm going to pay for your house and your maintenance and your expenses and your taxes and your vacancy, right? And then after I pay all that for you, I'm going to give you 100 bucks. Yeah, I'm great with that. Right? So, doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot, man.
So, yeah, definitely. So you still have a 9-to-5. How do you fit all that into your life? Just your, you know, work responsibilities and also, you know, responsibilities with growing the portfolio, managing things. What's the ideal for you?
Yeah, you know, the real estate doesn't take as much time as maybe it sounds like, or maybe as people who aren't doing it, right? Again, with the property management, the online tools really make it easy. So on the managing property side, the things that take time and effort are really showing properties, right? And then I've just tried to consolidate that as much as possible. So when I've got a vacant unit, I show open house style. I pick a time, right? I pick a lunchtime since I have to work a day job, or I pick a after 5 o'clock, or I pick a Saturday, right? At 12 or something. And I say, these are the times I'm going to be at the house. If you want to see it, these are the times you have to be there. Right. It's great for a couple of reasons. A, it fits my schedule, right? But B, it shows me, you know, who really wants to be there, right? Who's going to take the time, right? And come at that time and show up on time. So there's some business benefits and some personal benefits there to doing it that way. So those are the things that are taking the most time on the property management side. On the buying side, buying properties, what takes the most time is going and looking at houses, right? And I can schedule that at lunch times and after work. But like evaluating a deal or, you know, answering the phone, you know, it takes 5 minutes to have a phone call with a potential seller, right? So none of that really takes a lot of time. So I would say, you know, don't let the fact that you have a day job deter you from growing and scaling your business, right? There are tons of online tools. And again, right, if you don't have a job that won't allow you to step away to answer a 5-minute phone call, I mean, a lot of people are in that situation, that's fine. And maybe going the virtual assistant route is a good idea for you, right? You can always hire somebody for a little bit of money to answer your phone, right? Or go on the voicemail route, you know, having them leave a voicemail. So there's ways to do it in your day job. So yeah, man, it doesn't, there's not a lot of time suck on the day job side from real estate.
Definitely. And what does your wife think about all this and how fast things have grown? I'm sure it's much more than she could have imagined initially when you took out the 401k loan.
I am absolutely lucky and blessed to have the supportive, amazing wife that I do. She is all in, right? She is all in for the growth. And, you know, I think seeing how passionate I am is helpful, right? She also enjoys it, right? We started this journey together, you know, the same book that I read that got me hooked, she read, and it got her, you know, interested as well. And there's positive and good things that come out of it for her too, right? Because you know, we're flipping houses, and she's got the, you know, the design eye when we start staging houses and picking finishes, and you know, so she gets to do a lot of that fun stuff. And then, you know, there's a, you know, just we've been able to, you know, take some business trips and have some business expenses that we wouldn't have had we not had this business. That's been fun for us both too. So, and there's tons of upside in it, but it helped. It definitely helped her, you know, with the being supportive, because she can see the kind of fruits of the labor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's awesome. What is one piece? So remember in earlier on, you were talking about, you know, just kind of how you didn't know what you were going to do. You know, it was kind of, there was some nerves there, some fear when in the very, very beginning. Sure. But the big key is that you got over it and look where we are now. So what would be your one piece of advice you would give to someone who's interested in real estate investing, but they just have that fear. They just, the fear of the unknown or not being in control or losing their money. What would you say to someone like that?
Yeah. So for dealing with the fear, I think the thing that helped me the most get over the fear was writing it down. And I know that sounds like really simple, but if you've come to the conclusion that this is something that you think you would enjoy and would be beneficial to you, but you can't go to the fear hump. Write down exactly what it is that you're afraid of, right? And then continue to try to break that down to get to the source of it. So for me, before I started mailing, I got to the point where I was ready to mail and then I didn't do it, right? Because I got caught up in the, it's going to cost me some money. And then if it doesn't work, I'm going to lose this money, right? And so what I did was I wrote down, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of losing money. Okay. Well, how much money is that? Well, it's going to cost me $1,000 to send the letters, and it's going to cost me $500 to buy the list, right? So it's going to cost me $1,500, right? And when you only have $1,000 in your savings, $1,500 is a lot of money. So I didn't want to lose it. And so I said, okay, $1,500 is what you're scared of losing. All right. So what are some ways you could mitigate that risk of losing $1,500? And I said, okay, well, I could put that money on a credit card that's got an interest-only payment, right? And I said, all right, what's out there? I Googled interest-only credit cards. I found one that was interest-only for, I think it was 15 months. And I said, all right, so interest-only for 15 months. $1,500 divided by 15 months, that gives you your monthly payment. I said, worst case scenario, if I spend this $1,500, I don't get any deals, then I have to make a monthly payment of, I'm bad at math, so whatever that is, for 15 months. Can you do that? Can you afford to do that? I looked at my finances. I said, yes, I can afford to make that payment, right? So then it wasn't a risk of losing $1,500 anymore. It was a risk of losing whatever that monthly payment was, which I already determined is something I can afford to do. So then it wasn't so scary anymore. Right. Once I saw and broke it all down and realized what I was actually afraid of and what it actually might cost me. Right. And that I can actually afford to take the risk. I wasn't scared anymore. And so I started the marketing campaign and I made 10 grand on that first marketing campaign. So, yeah, $1,500 was worth it. Right. And had I not gotten a deal, it still would have been worth it to me, because the lessons I learned in that first marketing campaign were much more valuable than the $1,500 I spent. So I would say, if you're scared, break it down, write down exactly what you're scared of, right? And then ask yourself, is this a real fear? Is it A or B? And if it is a real fear, is it a fear that you can mitigate and make something you're more comfortable with? And if the answer to that is yes, then go ahead and jump, right? And if the answer to that is no, which totally may be legit, you may totally have a legit fear that you don't need to take that risk, right? But don't just say you're scared and not try to figure out if you can mitigate that risk first, because then you'll never get started.
Definitely, definitely. And have you considered other markets, or are you just trying to do as much as you can locally until, you know, you've captured most of the market?
Yeah, no, I have considered other markets. This market's just really good right now. I don't have a need to purchase outside of this market on the residential real estate side. Mm-hmm. On the commercial real estate side, looking at storage facilities, yeah, I may be doing some looking outside of just this immediate area. But from a residential standpoint, no, here's where I feel like I can be the most impact right now.
Definitely, definitely. And I meant to ask this earlier, but your portfolio, is it just kind of a mix of single and multifamilies? Is it most of one type?
Yep. Mostly duplexes and singles.
Okay.
I have one 8-unit property that we purchased, but it's 4 duplexes that were all on 1-2 lots. So
okay. Cool. And are there any books or resources that helped you that you recommend for our listeners to look into just to learn more about real estate investing?
Yeah, for sure. Outside of the Rich Dad Poor Dad that I mentioned earlier, I would say books that have been super helpful are, one, The Alchemist I read. So not a real estate book, not really a business book, but more just a book about, like, if you're doing the things that you feel like you should be doing, like, the universe will kind of help conspire to help get a realization for you. And that was kind of a good motivating book for me to just kind of help me stay focused on doing the things I feel like I need to do in my business. So I really enjoyed that book. I've also enjoyed, I read The Millionaire Real Estate Investor, Gary Keller's book, which was super helpful because it kind of broke down all the aspects of kind of buying and selling and finding deals. I enjoyed the when I first got started, I read the Wholesaling Bible. Van Merle, I think, wrote that book. And that book was really good just for, like, kind of how to go find a deal, evaluate a deal, and determine if that deal is going to make sense for you. It was kind of like a go-getter, getting started book. But it, if you've never done a deal, like, it kind of does a good job breaking down what a deal should look like and how to kind of go find a deal and how to build a business and make yourself, you know, marketable and presentable. Yeah, man, those were some good ones I enjoyed when I first got started.
Cool. And I have to ask, what has been your most challenging tenant experience thus far?
Challenging tenant experience. I would say this tenant that just, so the very first deal, I said the guy just moved out and I'm doing some light rehab. He was probably my most challenging tenant experience. Only in that I had to give him a substantial increase in rent, right? And so I tried to, you know, it's tough when you have to walk in and raise somebody's rent by quite a bit, right? So for the house he was living in, I had to take him from like $850 a month to $1,100 a month, right? And what I did with him was I said, hey, it was actually $1,200 a month was what the market was. And so I said, hey, here is a few other rentals in the neighborhood. So I just went to Zillow and found some other houses close by and kind of what they're asking. And I said, here's what people are paying in this neighborhood, right? And so this is the potential that I look to make property. I understand, I wanted, you know, proof behind why I was asking them to make that jump. And so, and then I gave him the option to move. I said, I would love to have you stay. Here's where I need you to stay, and here's why, where I need you to stay at rent-wise, right? Take 60 days, right? Go shop around, see if you can find something, right? I'll give you a couple months rent at your current rate till you find something, right? And then let me know what you want to do. And they did, they shopped around. They couldn't really find anything. I'm sure they found some things, but you have to weigh the cost of moving too, right? With what you could just up your rent to stay where you are. And so they chose to stay. So I learned some lessons in kind of how to raise rent and how to be fair and all that there. And then I learned some lessons with, like, how you have to be fair but firm, because they didn't, the very first month they asked me, could they, you know, split their rent payment up, or, right, could they split the deposit up? And I had to learn quickly that I couldn't really bend on some of those things if I wanted them to continue to pay on time. So I had some challenges with getting him to pay on time, but I continued to try to go out of my way to work with him within reason, right? And he paid rent every month until the last month. He would just always pay late. And so that's where the challenges were. It was a little more labor intensive than any of my other tenants. But again, I take that as I'm learning something in this that I didn't hope for, right? So that, at some point when I have a property manager and they have a problem with a tenant, I can either understand what they're doing and realize that, you know, I need to let them handle the situation, or understand that they're not doing enough in the situation because I've been there.
Right. Definitely. Awesome. Well, Henry, wow. I'm blown away. I really had a lot of fun in this interview and learning more about what you've been doing and how you scaled so quickly in a year. I'm just beyond inspired. So I know that our listeners will get tremendous value out of this interview. A lot of practical things we can kind of apply to our own journey. So just want to thank you again for reaching out. Thank you again for hopping on. And this has just been great. Looking forward to keeping in touch.
Thank you so much, man. I've enjoyed this and I'm happy to share, man. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for tuning into the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. Look forward to connecting with you all soon.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.